so much for being here, members and visitors alike. As most of you are aware, I had the house to myself last week. All my family was out gallivanting, and one of them catching an illness like death. So while I had the house to myself, I watched a few movies. I bet you could probably guess one of the titles that I watched. We're not going to screen the movie, by the way. It's not the time or place, nor is it my intention here to convince everybody to go home and watch this movie. If you do, that's fine. I think it's a great movie, at least this version of it, the modern version with the guy from Guardians of the Galaxy. I could care less about that. But the original one, I enjoyed very much. That's not the point. The point is that the movie reminded me of some Bible characters I'd like to share with you here. The Magnificent Seven was described to me recently, and I read an article that described it as being a superhero movie. And I said, yeah, that's what it is. It's a superhero movie, except without the costumes and without the superpowers and without the special effects and all that kind of thing. It's people taking on ridiculous chances and facing horrible defeat and awful odds, simply because it's the right thing to do. It's because it needs doing, a job that needs doing, and there's only a handful of people who are willing to do it. And that is, in many ways, the story of the Bible as well. We have, and we read the text from Hebrews chapter 11, the last part of it, and going into the first part of chapter 12, where it just kind of sums up what happens in the Bible story. We have some of these stories, we don't have some of these stories, but it just goes on and on. People who did remarkable things. And they did it because it was the right thing to do, because it was their service to God and their service to their brethren, and they were glad to do it, and oftentimes paid the ultimate price for it. And that sort of service, that sort of heroism, deserves some attention. And so we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about some Bible characters here today, and I don't mean to suggest that these are the seven greatest characters in the Bible or the seven most heroic characters in the Bible or anything like that. They just happen to fit the story fairly well. And so we're going to focus on them, and I would encourage you to study these characters some more and develop your own list if you want to, and be very glad to hear your feedback on the topic at hand. At any rate, so I'm presenting to you here the Magnificent Seven of the Bible. The first one is Elijah, and might as well tell you a little bit about the movie, because it's not going to make any sense if we don't do that. Yul Brynner is the main character here, and he is in charge of putting this group together that's going to go down and cross the border in New Mexico. There's a town that's being overrun by a warlord played by Eli Wallach, and it's really, really horrible. And the only thing I can think of is to bring some gunmen in there to teach them how to defend themselves against his robbery and harassment in general. And they figured out that they're able to pay these people $20 to get this job done. And that doesn't seem like very much money, and it's not very much money, but that Yul Brynner takes it on. He says, okay, we'll go ahead and do this. And ultimately, it doesn't matter whether, he's not trying to find seven people, he's trying to find enough people. And if it winds up being him by himself, he's going to go by himself. He's going to do the right thing. It reminds me of Elijah in that way. Elijah is the moral idealist. This is the right thing to do, and so I'm going to do it. And it may not go very well, and I may not have a whole lot of company when I do it, but nevertheless, it's the right thing. And so therefore, I'm going to do the right thing. And that kind of idealism, that kind of purity of thought is a real encouragement to me. 1 Kings chapter 17 and the first few verses there introduces, Elijah kind of comes in on a whirlwind. He goes out on a whirlwind too, as it turns out, but he kind of comes in out of nowhere, pronounces this doom and gloom upon the entire country. There's going to be no rain in the nation until I say so. And then, of course, he starts suffering the consequences of this 3-year drought. He has to go out in the wilderness and try to find food and water. God provides for him, of course. Eventually, his water runs out, too. He's suffering just as well as anybody else. But that doesn't mean he did the wrong thing. That doesn't mean he was inappropriate in doing what he did. It was the right thing to do, standing up against Ahab and against Ahab's habits, which had brought a certain amount of comfort, a certain degree of safety to the nation. But under the circumstances that he had brought it brought in idolatry and foreign alliances and a really, really bad marriage. And it was bad news in general for the nation. Elijah wasn't going to have it. He was going to oppose this with everything that he had. And if that meant being on the run, if that meant being hungry or thirsty or alone, He was perfectly willing to do that because it was, you know, he's going to whine about it a little bit later on, but that's another story. He is going to do it, though. It's what is the right thing to do. This brand of righteousness, this brand of godliness is going to come from our character and not from our circumstances. Our circumstance is going to reveal the righteousness. It's going not going to have a determining factor on whether we're considered righteous or not. You are a godly person. You're a righteous person. You're a holy person because you've chosen to do this. It's not because you got lucky or unlucky, as the case may be, with your circumstances. Righteous people like Elijah are going to act like they act, regardless of what happens. Now, it very well may be that your holiness, your life of godliness before the Lord, is going to cost you something. I'm not going to pretty much guarantee it's going to cost you something at some point in your life. It may cost you something big. That doesn't mean you made a bad decision just because you suffer bad consequences. Elijah understood that going in, and we need to understand it as well. There's a certain sense in which serving God is an either-or proposition. And Elijah is a really big black-and-white kind of guy. You're going to do the right thing or you're going to do the wrong thing, and there's no in-between. That's what he told the people at Mount Carmel. You remember the great showdown that he has with Ahab and the prophets of Baal in chapter 18, verse number 21 particularly. He says, how long are you going to hesitate between two opinions to the people there? You're trying to worship God and Baal, and you can't do that. Now, maybe the Baal people are okay with that, but God's not okay with that, and I'm not okay with that. You need to decide. Are you Jehovah worshipers? And if so, this is the way you go. And if you're Baal worshipers, then that's the way that you go over there. But decide one way or the other. You're either going to be on God's side or not on God's side. And I really think that the more we think about our service to God in those black and white terms, the easier this whole thing is going to be for us. The easier it's going to be for it to fall together for us. Simply because God said this is the way we're supposed to do it. That should be good enough for us. It was good enough for Elijah. It ought to be good enough for us as well. Now, it may work out for us. It may not work out for us. But ultimately, the people who are willing to serve God are going to find a way to serve God. Simply because it's their character, because that's what they've chosen to do with their life. Steve McQueen's character is somewhat different. He is also an adventurer, a gunman for hire and that sort of thing. But he has a way out. He's been told that he has a job waiting for him as a grocer. Which, as one of the Mexicans tells him, it's going to pay a lot better than $20. That's maybe a better way for you to go. But that's not what he wants out of his life. He wants something real. He wants something, you know, a job that he can be proud of, a job that he can that means something, a life of meaning, a life of purpose, basically. He reminds me of Isaiah with regard to that. Isaiah is somebody who finds an opportunity to serve in the cause of God in a very special way. Exactly what Isaiah was doing when he saw this vision in chapter 6, we don't know. What his background was, or he must have been relatively young because he stays in God's service a long, long, long time. Probably the longest tenured prophet of them all, except for maybe Daniel. But he receives this vision of God and the splendor of God's holiness. And he's just blown away by it, and he feels completely unworthy of it. I live in a nation of unclean lips. I have unclean lips. It's not right for me to see this. And God purifies him symbolically in this magical vision that he's seen. And then this call goes out. Who's going to go forth? Who's going to share my message with the people who need it? And Isaiah, in that great answer that we all know fairly well, Isaiah said, here am I. Send me. Now, I want to go. I want to be a part of this. Now, Isaiah didn't understand what he was getting into, I'm sure. But he understood enough. He understood that this is a way that I can serve God. This is a way that I can contribute to God's cause, a way that's available to me, and something that I want to grab hold of. He understood, and I think he came to understand even more, because that's the way service to God works. He understood even more that answering God's call is what you are all about. Ecclesiastes 12:13, right? The fear of God and keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of man. This is everything that you're about, everything that you're ever intended to be about, is serving God, answering that call. When the gospel goes out and finds your ears and finds your heart, and you give yourself over to that, you have not only saved your soul, You've not only delivered yourself from Satan's clutches, but you've also given yourself a reason to live that was far more important than anything you ever had before. You may have thought your life had purpose, but now suddenly you realize that whatever purpose that was is meaningless in comparison. You have found your way in your life. What your life is all about, what your life was always intended to be all about. The greatest purpose there possibly could be. Now, the thing about Isaiah, and we kind of paraphrased the reading earlier. Let me flip over there briefly and read the rest of it. In Isaiah chapter 6, God's not done after Isaiah says yes. Lots of times you ask somebody to volunteer for a job, they say yes and we're done. If you really want the job done, you probably don't stick around and tell them how horrible the job is. But that's what God does. God does that for Isaiah here. After he says, "Here am I, send me," God says in verse number 9, he said, "Go and tell this people, keep on listening, but do not perceive. Keep on looking, but do not understand. Render the hearts of this people insensitive, their ears dull, and their eyes dim. Otherwise, they might see with their eyes and hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and return and be healed." And Isaiah's response to that is probably what mine would have been under those circumstances. How long? Either how long am I have to do that, or how long are they going to have that attitude? And either way, it amounts to the same thing, right? I'd really like to have some positive results here. Maybe we can have some positive results at the end of this. Well, no, probably not. How long? And he answered, until cities are devastated and without inhabitant, houses without people, and the land is utterly desolate. The Lord has removed men far away, and the forsaken places are many in the midst of the land. Yet there will be a tenth portion in it. And it will indeed be subject to burning like a terebinth or an oak whose stump remains when it is felled. The holy seed is its stump. Well, that's not the most cheerful pepper-upper you ever heard, probably. If you're giving your life to the Lord, and the very first thing that happens is God tells you, and by the way, it's going to be a total waste. None of this is going to work. You're going out to preach to people who don't want to listen to you, and after they listen to you, they're not going to want to listen to you anymore. They're going to turn a deaf ear to you, and at the end of the day, they're going to be punished. They're going to be punished very severely. The long-term impact that you have for these people here is pretty negligible. Well, you know, you might be inclined not to follow through with that. Steve McQueen was inclined for a little bit maybe to not follow through with that when he realized how bad the job was and how utterly awful their chances were. But he winds up sticking around. He winds up seeing the job through to the end because that's ultimately the kind of person that he is. It's not about finding a job that's worth doing that you might be able to survive. It's finding a job that matters. It's finding something that is meaningful here. And if you are willing and you are able to find that purpose, to seek it out and to put it to work in your life. We sang about Joshua a few moments ago. Taylor picked a great song to go along with the sermon idea here. Dare to stand like Joshua. Joshua was told in the very beginning, be strong and very courageous, multiple times in chapter 1. If you will pray for courage, if you will pray for help in this task that God has set before you, God will give you that help. God will encourage you and help you accomplish this task, the seemingly impossible task sometimes that he has set before you. James Coburn is sometimes forgotten in the movie. He doesn't say a lot. He's very understated. It's a great character for him. Reminds me a little bit about Barnabas. He's a guy who kind of stays in the background, not necessarily a lot of attention to himself, but when it comes down to it, he absolutely gets the job done. Nobody's more effective in the task that's set before them than James Coburn's character is here. And by the way, they all have names. I don't know their names. I didn't bother learning their names about this. I'll probably watch the movie another 10 times and still won't know their names. But anyway, Barnabas, I do know his name. We know his name, right? His name was Joseph. But he got nicknamed Barnabas because of the kind of person that he was. Barnabas was the kind of person who is able to mentor a young man like Saul of Tarsus and put him in a position to succeed and take him out on a preaching tour and watch him develop as a preacher and a powerhouse for the gospel to such an extent where it really didn't make any sense for Barnabas to talk very much. And so he quit talking. And Saul, who was by then known as Paul, he did the talking in chapter 14 of Acts. This is already the roles they found for themselves in the middle of their first preaching tour. They think they're Greek gods and Paul is Hermes because he's the one that does all the talking, and Barnabas is Zeus, presumably because he's tall and powerful and such, maybe taller than Paul was. At any rate, he's content with this. He's okay being on the sidelines because ultimately the job was more important than his own personal self-aggrandizement. He was more than prepared to do the work, whether it was going to be with Paul or without Paul, and eventually it became without Paul. At the end of chapter 15, they separate. They're planning to go on another tour, and they have different ideas about how they're going to go about doing that. Barnabas is willing to give John Mark a second chance, and Paul is not. And so they part ways. But that doesn't matter. Barnabas is going to continue to do his good work, and he's going to trust that Paul's going to do his work as well, which of course he did. This is the work of someone who is committed completely to other people. Now, I said before that Barnabas' name is actually Joseph. He's nicknamed Barnabas by the apostles because he's such an encourager. The son of consolation, the son of encouragement is the way that Barnabas is rendered. It's a nickname, basically, that derives from Joseph's character. This is who he was. This is what he did on a regular basis. And what he did basically was always minimize his own importance, putting himself in the background to the point of selling what appears to have been a relatively valuable piece of property and giving it entirely over to the apostles. Now, there's good work that needs to be done here. Go ahead, I don't need this. You can go ahead and have it. That's the kind of person that Barnabas was on a regular basis. He understood, we also need to understand, that true glory is going to come from God. Glory is not something you set out to achieve for yourself. Now, maybe talking about Westerns is not the best way to prove this point, because a lot of self-glorification going on in Westerns. Nevertheless, we understand when we read the Bible, and we read about Bible characters like Barnabas, that this is about finding a way to honor God and allowing God to honor us. Let him who boasts boast in the Lord, the text says in 1 Corinthians 1 and verse 31. If we will humble ourselves in the sight of the God, we have confidence that he will exalt us in due course of time. Charles Bronson's character is interesting. Charles Bronson he plays a man who is half Mexican, which is a pretty good trick for someone who was named Charles Buchinski when he was born. He's half Mexican, and so therefore the Mexican kids kind of gravitate toward him, and they see him as a mentor type guy. And then before too long, they're comparing Charles Bronson to their fathers, who are farmers and peasants, and not very equipped, not very brave, and they don't really know much about guns and that sort of thing. And eventually, one of the boys just shouts out that he was embarrassed about his father. His father was a coward, and Charles Bronson grabbed the boy. They did this back in movies back 50 years ago. Okay, they bent him over his knee and started beating the boy on the bottom with his hands, showing you do not disrespect your father like that. Your father is deserving of respect. He has to have your respect. Charles Bronson's probably my favorite of all of these, I have to say. Elisha is kind of like that. Elisha is someone whose entire career is based on the idea of respect. Respect for authority, especially the authority of his own mentor, who we don't know anything about his father and his relationship with his father, but we do know about his relationship with Elijah. That Elijah was his teacher and his mentor. And Elisha wanted more than anything else to walk in his mentor's footsteps. And as Elijah is going toward his end, he's traveling across the country, and Elisha is with him, and they keep meeting with other prophets, and the prophets all know that Elijah is at the end, and they keep asking Elisha, you know, your mentor's leaving us. Yes, I know, leave me alone, I want to talk to him about something. And the next time they come to, hey, your mentor is leaving us. Yes, I know that, leave me alone, I want to talk to him about something. And finally they get across the Jordan, and Elijah has what he has to say. He says, I want a double portion of your power. I want that same kind of power that you have in a double portion, which I do not think means he wanted twice as much power as Elijah. That doesn't seem to fit the metaphor very well. It really seems to be more of a reference to the birthright aspect of the Old Testament culture, that Elijah was going to pass on his authority and his power, to a certain degree at least, to others. Of course, God's going to empower those who he chooses. But Elisha wants to fill that role. He wants to be the heir, the primary heir to Elijah. And he says, well, that's not my job to say, but if God chooses, then he'll let us know. If you stick around and see the end, and of course Elisha did stick around and see the end. We talked about the the whirlwind before. He goes out and this fiery chariot in a whirlwind, and Elisha's just blown away by this. And the very first thing that he does, he picks up the mantle of the of his master, is a metaphor that we use even today. And he hits the Jordan River with the mantle just like his mentor did. And he says, "Where is God, the God of Elijah?" And sure enough, the water parts just like it did for Elijah, showing that God had in fact given that power that Elijah had had, passed it on to Elisha. The Lord God of Elijah is the one, ultimately, who gets the glory for this. He is the one who is honored in the things that Elisha is going to do. So it's not just the authority of Elijah that he respects. It's the authority of Elisha, the authority of God, rather, that is important as well. Now, the authority of Elisha is important also. And we see this very early in the Elijah story. And this, again, comes back to the idea of authority and the need for a respect for authority, not only in our own lives, but in the lives of people that we're dealing with. Elisha, on his way home, encounters some young men who seem to think that his baldness is an object of ridicule. And they're kind of laughing at him a little bit. And he curses them. And a couple of she-bears come out and beat the little boys up. The more hair I lose, the more funny I find that story to be. And we don't want to be just overly cruel about this, but nevertheless, the idea of authority is important. And young people, those who are sometimes look with disdain upon their elders, the elder generation, remember this. Those who have gone before need our authority, need our respect and our honor. The more old and the more experience that we, the more age and the more experience they acquire for ourselves, the more deference, the more honor we have earned, the hoary head. We're supposed to rise up before the hoary head. Likewise, when we look at someone who is more experienced than we are, we need to respect that authority that they have simply because of their experience in life. And certainly that goes for parents and grandparents, and goes for church elders and other authority figures that tend to be on the older side as well. We'll move on. Robert Vaughn. Robert Vaughn is the PTSD fellow in the group. What we would call today PTSD, anyway. He's got a background, he's got a lot of baggage, and he has a lot of nightmares and frights and such. He's terrified, essentially, at all times. Not because of what is facing him at the moment, because of what happened in the past. And he's finding it impossible to let go of what had happened in the past. And it's winding up governing his future, unfortunately. To a certain degree, it reminds me of Paul, as far as this goes. Because we know that Paul was eaten up, to a certain degree at least, with guilt feelings. Paul, when he was first known as Saul of Tarsus, of course, comes on the scene as an oppressor of the church. You know the story. He's someone who gave his vote against certain ones, indicating that he may have had some degree of authority in matters such as the Stephen stoning and perhaps other situations as well. He was an open advocate of persecuting the church. And then he became a Christian himself. But that wasn't the end of the story. He tells Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 15, he still considered himself to be the chief of sinners. And I think at least in part, he's talking about his background. He's talking about his baggage that he never left behind. I've heard some argue that the thorn in the flesh that Paul wrestles with in 2 Corinthians chapter 12 is his guilt feelings, the hard feelings that he's had about his own past. I don't know about that, how true that is, but nevertheless, it's pretty clear that he had trouble oftentimes letting go of what had happened in the past. And he finally winds up finding a place to move forward, to forget what lies behind and reach forward to that which lies before, he says in Philippians chapter 3. Because he realizes that no amount of mourning, no amount of sadness, no amount of regret or penance or good deeds can ever undo anything that ever happened. All that we can do is ask for forgiveness and rejoice that we're forgiven. And none of that is going to, I don't know if it's going to make him sleep better at night or not. But hopefully it will, at least in the confidence that whether you can forgive yourself or not, God has forgiven you. And maybe if you realize how much God has forgiven you, you can begin to slowly forgive yourself. What we need to do is fight the fight. Not give up. Not quit. because it's become difficult, because it's too difficult or challenging, or it brings back too many memories, or whatever it happens to be. We need to live our lives in the right way. We need to do the right thing, continue to do the right thing as much as we possibly can, as hard as we possibly can. Give our lives entirely over to the Lord. That's what Paul did. I doubt that there was a, if I were like Paul anyway, I don't think there'd be a day that I wouldn't see in my mind a picture of Stephen dying. But that doesn't have to ruin your life. It doesn't have to govern your life. You can move forward. You can praise God that He has forgiven you for every sin in your life, including that. And then devote whatever is left of your life, however much of it there may be, to living for the Lord. Crucifying yourself to the Lord. Galatians 2 verse 20, right? I've been crucified with Christ, no longer I live, but Christ lives in me. I've given up my life. The life that I now live, I live in faith, he says. Faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. This is the confidence that we have as children of God, that our lives can still matter, our lives can still be effective, no matter how ugly and unfortunate our past may have been. Brad Dexter's character is a little bit of a stretch, and I will admit that. He's the fortune hunter of the group. He's convinced that there's money in this deal. And he's told any number of times, no, there's not, no, there's not. And he says, okay, whatever. He believes that at the end of this process, he's going to be paid, and he's not going to get paid $20. It's going to be a lot better than that. And in that sense, he kind of reminds me of Abraham. And I hope I'm not being disrespectful to Abraham when I say that. Because especially when you read the account in Hebrews, that we see that Abraham is serving God because it's the right thing to do in the short term. Because following after God is best. And going where God says is best. Yes. But there's more to it than that. That there is a greater reward, a greater payoff waiting for us on down the line. Hebrews 11 verse 8 tells us, by faith Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out into a place where he was about to receive, which he was to receive for an inheritance, and he went out not knowing where he was going. He didn't understand any of this. He simply went because God told him to go, and he believed that at least in part, the shortcomings, well, let me restart that sentence because it's not in part, it's in whole. He believed that by serving God in the short term, by going where God has told him to go, and living in this land that was never going to be his own, or his sons or his grandsons, he had confidence that his life was not only meaningful and important in the short term, that he was also going to receive a home of his own, a real home, just not of this flesh. Reading in chapter 11 again, skipping down to verse 14. Verse 14. For those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own. People like Abraham, that is. And indeed, if they had been thinking of that country from which they went out, they would have opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. Abraham used to live in a city. In his, it was my age. I was going to say his youth. I guess he was 75 when he started living the country life. But he understood about cities. And he could have gone back to his old city if he'd wanted to. But he wanted God's city. He believed that God was going to reward him in a much greater sense than he ever could have rewarded himself in Ur of the Chaldees or any other place. He didn't need details. I'm sure he wanted details like the rest of us do, but he didn't need details. All he needed was faith. And if he had that faith, that was going to get him through the difficult times. And that faith will get us through the difficult times as well. Having confidence in God is going to give us what the text calls us here in verse number 1, the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. All the important things in your life are invisible. All of them. The really important things. God, heaven, faith, hell, the devil. All of these things are critically important. And you haven't ever seen any of them, but you have faith. And because you have faith, you realize that you can, in fact, look forward to a real reward, a real payday, far beyond your wildest imaginations, much better than gold or silver or gems or oil or any of the rest of this stuff that human beings search for. God has something better in mind for you than that. And finally, we come to Horst Buchholz's character, the kid, essentially here. The one who is glomming on because he just thinks Yul Brynner hung the moon and wants more than anything be like his big hero or whatever. And when you are young, everything seems black and white. Everything seems easy. And you have all the energy in the world. I vaguely remember days like this. I can look at, you know, Brian and Caleb sitting back in the back. Yeah, I used to have all that kind of energy. Played 36 rounds of golf, holes of golf in one day. And, you know, yeah, I could have done that. I still could if I really wanted to, I guess. But got more sense than that now. David is a bundle of energy when he's a young one. And you know, we think of David as being this little, you know, little tyke, Peyton's age or something like that, going out and killing Goliath. Clearly, he's not that young. He's young. He's big enough to fit in Saul's armor, and Saul's a big guy. So he must have been relatively grown at this stage. But nevertheless, he's young enough to realize that this is not as complicated as people want to make it out to be. We got this gigantic Philistine over there who is insulting the people of God and insulting God, and I'm not going to stand for it. And if you guys want to stand for it, that's your business. But I'm not going to stand for it. I will take him on. I will take him out. And he has no doubt going into this that this is the right thing to do. In fact, the speech that he gives here in chapter 17 of 1 Samuel is pretty amazing, especially under the circumstances. We may have said things like this to the mirror. I don't know if you ever said it to a 10-foot giant before. But that's what David does. In verse number 45 and following, David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. This day the Lord will deliver you up into my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head from you, and I will give the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or spear, but for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands." What a marvelous speech that is before the battle. But then the battle commences, and it turns out that David has overprepared. Remember how the kids remember, right? He went to the brook, and how much ammo did he bring to the fight here? Brought 5 smooth stones, right? Which turns out to be 4 too many. That's what faith will do. Faith puts you in a position to succeed. And succeed in remarkable things. He realized that God is the one who is going to give the victory here. And therefore it doesn't matter how young I am or how ill-equipped I am or how inexperienced I am. It doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is serving God and being on the side of God. And that God will win any battle that he puts his mind to. And by God's grace, David is able to continue. Not only survives this remarkable battle, but he also goes on to fight bigger battles, greater causes. And that's what God will do for us. If we live our youth, our young days, in such a way as to serve God, and that simple black and white pattern that we talked about with the Elijah section, if we can just find a way to serve God and honor God in these, believe it or not, teenagers, relatively simple circumstances that you're into, you can prepare yourself for much greater battles in your 20s, your 30s, your 50s, your 80s, where you are capable of doing remarkable things for the Lord, even more remarkable than you're capable of doing now, if you will put yourself to the task in the short term. Paul lectures Timothy a little bit on this subject, who is not exactly a child at this point. He's been serving the Lord for close to 20 years probably at this point. But he tells him in 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse number 12, let no one look down on your youthfulness, but rather in speech, conduct, love, faith, and purity, show yourself an example of those who believe. If you believe, if you're willing to give yourself over to God, your youth can be a weapon instead of a liability. The shortcomings that come with youth, and there are shortcomings, are manageable shortcomings, especially with the help of older mentors. You can survive, you can thrive, you can succeed if you'll completely and totally give yourself over to this task and trust that God is going to help you in these difficult times. If he helped David, then surely he can help us as well. Anyway, as I said, that's 7 stories, and we could easily tell 70 more, but we're not going to do that. We're going to stop here. And I want to encourage you, though, to read Hebrews chapter 11, read other Bible stories, read 1 and 2 Kings and other Genesis, great stories, especially in the Old Testament, of people who gave themselves to the Lord, ordinary people, just like you and me, who became superheroes, who took upon themselves a task that is just absolutely remarkable. Who maybe didn't feel like they were up to it. People like Esther, for instance, or Deborah, Jael. If you want, we didn't talk about any women. We could have talked about seven remarkable women too, probably. Anybody can be a child of God. Anybody can be a hero if you'll have faith. And we encourage you to adopt that faith in your life today. If there's something we can do to help you with regard to that, if there's a way that we can assist you in your growth, if there's a way that we can assist you in coming to the Lord and making His life your life, maybe by being baptized in water for remission of sins, we emphasized that this morning, we'll emphasize it again today. You need to give yourself over to Jesus. You need to be baptized in His name. And if you're ready to do that, or if in some other way we can help you walk with Christ more perfectly and help you prepare for a heavenly home waiting for you after this life is over, please respond to the invitation at this time while we stand and sing to encourage you.